a good couple of 20-minute efforts into every ride that they're doing, and then have one day then where they're just doing the bigger mileage, and just getting that zone two ride in, and yeah, building on time on the bike, basically.
That Triathlon Show, episode 88. Hey, what's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I talk to fellow Scandinavian and fellow Swedish-speaking coach Magnus Maggie Bäckstedt. He's a former road cyclist and, among other achievements, a Paris-Roubaix winner. And did you know, by the way, that about me, that I'm Swedish-speaking and not Finnish-speaking? I'm not sure I've been talking about that before on the podcast, but that's the fact. Swedish is a minority language, an official language in Finland. So there, you may have learned something new today. Anyway, I talked to Magnus Bäckstedt, and we discuss things like indoor versus outdoor cycling for triathletes, the intensity versus volume debate. Maybe it's not one or the other. Anyway, we'll hear Magnus' take on the two variables of training. How important are power meters, really? And can you get by on just heart rate if you don't have one? We get into mistakes that triathletes typically make in their bike training. And finally, one very, very interesting thing is we discuss what Magnus did in his swimming and running when he got into age group triathlon after his professional cycling career, quite a bit after, I believe. But he became very competitive and qualified for Kona within 8 months of starting out. And as you'll hear, it isn't because he was some kind of supernatural at swimming or running, but just hearing his approach and what he used and how you can apply his learnings is something that I think will be very useful for you. But first, this episode is sponsored by Precision Hydration. They provide great tasting electrolyte drinks to match your individual needs, because one size does not fit all when it comes to hydration and when it comes to sweat sodium losses specifically. Their drinks prevent cramps, they enable you to get the best out of your performance, and did I say that they taste great? As a personal anecdote, I just got a big box of PH products that didn't fit in my luggage when I moved here to Lisbon from Helsinki back in October, when a friend came to visit here and brought this Precision Hydration pack with them, and I must say it felt like Christmas to get a whole new pack of PH electrolyte products, because I go through a lot of it with long rides on both Saturdays and Sundays on weekends, and it's a very important part for me for performing in my workouts, so definitely I was happy about that. Anyway, check them out on precisionhydration.com, take their free sweat test to get your personalized hydration strategy, and if you want to buy any other products, use the discount code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, for 15% off. Now, just a quick bio about Magnus. His full name is Magnus Bäckstedt. As I said, he is a cycling and triathlon coach from Sweden living in the UK. He's the head coach and founder of Bäckstedt Coaching. But from his road cycling days, he has achievements like in 2004 winning the Paris-Roubaix. He has won stages of the Tour de France, of the Giro d'Italia, and he's a Swedish national road race champion. And as I mentioned, he has qualified for Kona and now coaches both cyclists and triathletes and does bike fitting. Big shoutouts and thank yous to loyal listeners of the show, Chris Massey, who is coached by Maggie, and he set up this interview or helped set up this interview. He connected the two of us, and I really, really appreciate that, since I didn't know of Magnus from before. And I really, really think that this was a great discussion and one of the interviews that I've done recently that I've learned the most from and got really a lot out of. So big thanks, Chris, for that. And also to Dan Mew, that's the other thank you and shout out I want to make. He sent in some questions that you'll hear towards the end of this interview for Magnus to answer. And just to give you a heads up about that, I sometimes post on Facebook before doing an interview if I want listener questions, and that's what I did in this case, and then responded to that Facebook post. So you can go and like Scientific Triathlon on Facebook, and that will, among other things, give you the opportunity to ask questions of great guests in the future. But obviously you'll of course get to know about all new episodes when they are released and some other cool stuff, and you can post there yourself if you want to. So enough of the chit chat, let's hear the interview with Magnus Bäckstedt. All right, so today on That Triathlon Show, I'm very happy to welcome Magnus Bäckstedt. Welcome, Magnus, or Maggie, as you're called. How's it going?
Very good, thank you. Very good.
What have you been up to? You're in the UK now, living there, and you've been doing some coaching or cycling. How's your day been so far?
Well, it's been pretty good. I mean, I've been living over here in the UK now since 2004, I think it was, just after I won Paris-Roubaix. I keep myself busy with commentating, coaching a lot of people. I had a couple of years when I was doing Ironman triathlons as well, just after my sort of second retirement of in the cycling career. It's just been very, very interesting over the last 2 years now, really, of just coaching cyclists and triathletes, really.
Yeah, we'll get into that. That's very interesting that you got into Ironman, and very successfully so. One thing to mention is that you're actually coaching one, the listener of the show that tipped me off to get you on the show, Chris. So that was a fun piece of trivia that I thought is worth mentioning. But what we've been thinking of for this interview is basically to talk about bike training for triathletes, because you have obviously a very very good professional cycling career behind you, so you know a lot about cycling, but then you have that triathlon career as well, and have been coaching triathletes, so a very broad perspective on this topic. So let's start with one of the most common questions this time of year, especially now that we're heading into winter. What's your take on indoor compared to outdoor cycling for triathletes?
Well, I think as any cyclist, whether you're a triathlete or whether you're a road cyclist, this time of the year, with certainly if you're living up in sort of northern part of Europe, then I think you just got to use common sense to start off with. If it's icy outside or if it's below minus degrees, then don't take your road bike out there and get caught out on some black ice or something like that and end up injuring yourself just for the fact of you have to get out on the road for X amount of time. There are so many things that you can do on an indoor trainer in one way or another to still progress and still at least maintain the fitness level that you have without taking the risk of getting injured. Because let's face it, if you're a triathlete and you come down on some ice and you hurt your shoulder, that's going to set you back pretty significantly with your swimming going forward and may even seriously hamper the rest of your career as a triathlete. So, I believe that you can do an awful lot of good work on an indoor trainer if you have to.
Do you have an opinion on whether it's even more effective, or do you think that both are needed in certain proportions? Because I know there are a lot of people that do all of their training indoors, and a lot of people that are proponents of doing it because it's so effective and can be so effective. But then we also have the principles of specificity come into play when you are going to be racing outside and that sort of thing. So how would you, from a long-term perspective or a season, for example, consider the relative importance of indoor and outdoor cycling training?
I mean, indoor training, you can always have a much more regulated type of effort. You know, it's quantifiable. It's always going to be 20 minutes. It's always going to be 20 minutes, and you can press on as hard as you should be doing for that without any kind of restriction. So it's a lot more controllable to run on an indoor trainer. But as far as I'm concerned, cycling should be done outdoors. I love going outdoors, and I think most people who ride bikes love riding the bikes outdoors. Just doing all your intervals, all your bike training on an indoor trainer, I don't think that's going to necessarily get you the feel for what is actually needed to be done outdoors, because there's so many variables that you have to take into account, even during an Ironman, and a certain amount of technique training coming into play as well. So there are very few corners that you have to deal with on a turbo trainer, obviously, whereas when you're out racing, you've got to deal with those kind of things. So I'm much more of an advocate for doing outdoor training in real life scenarios. And most of us have got roads and certain stretches of roads where you can do your intervals on relatively undisturbed and keep it still as a sort of controlled an effort as you can possibly make it, but still getting that nice feeling of being outside.
So when you coach an athlete, would you have periods of the season when you get more closer to the race season that they don't have any indoor training at all, or would they usually still have maybe one workout per week that they do on the indoor trainer?
It very much depends on the athlete. And if an athlete is happy to spend time on an indoor trainer, then I'd go and sort of prescribe that type of an effort for them to do. If you are like me, who after too many injuries throughout my cycling season absolutely detest sitting on an indoor trainer, then you got to take that into account, because if an athlete is not happy, they're not going to perform, whether it's training or racing. So you got to make sure that the athlete, I think anyway, is happy, mentally stimulated, and enjoys the training, and that's when you get the maximum out of the training. So I think every case is so different. Every individual is exactly that, an individual. So you have to really make sure that you understand and know the people that you coach and work with them to get the maximum out of them.
Right. Let's move on to the next question that I have for you here, and that's about the intensity versus volume discussion. Versus is probably the wrong word, because it's not one or the other necessarily, but where do you stand on that spectrum? What are your thoughts on that topic?
You always need the volume to make you be able to do the distances that you need to do, certainly if you're doing Ironmans and longer distance races. But at the same time, just riding around and doing very little intensity is not going to be ideal either. So I tend to sort of bring the cycling road cycling type of training into even triathlon and Ironman triathlon at this point in time. And if you've got to do 4.5 hours on an Ironman course, or 5 hours or whatever it is, then you still need to do those hours, and you might as well put the efforts in whilst you're out doing it, rather than sitting there doing junk miles. And I think there are too many, especially triathletes, who go out and just ride the distance at a sort of highish or medium intensity, which really doesn't do an awful lot for you, because by the time you end up in that medium intensity, they kind of do everything, every training or a lot of their training in the sort of Ironman pace kind of level, then that's just breaking your body down all the time. I think you need to make sure that you have a distinction between the recovery part of your ride and the intensity part of your ride. And with that, you'll move your threshold higher, and you'll also be fresher and recover better for the following day's efforts.
You mentioned junk miles there, and what's how do you define junk miles? Is there such a thing as too low an intensity? And on, for example, long rides, even though we just talked about doing things at a moderate intensity, not necessarily being good either. Can you go into that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, junk miles to me is just when you actually go out and just sit on the bike. If you're going too easy, then obviously you're not going to get the benefit of the training. What I find most people are doing, both in cycling and in triathlon, is that they go that sort of medium pace where you're sort of you're going too hard to actually recover. You're not going hard enough to really push your threshold efforts and try and bring the power output up in terms of what you're capable of doing over that threshold. If you move your threshold, obviously your Ironman pace is going to move with that you're going to become a faster bike rider. So I think what we need to do is just make that distinction, go slow enough when you're recovering and when you're riding your base miles for it to be at a comfortable pace, that level two kind of intensity, and be very, very strict with that. And then move yourself up and do your threshold efforts, and anything in between that is basically no man's land, because that's where your race pace should end up for an Ironman, and it also does for a bike rider, and that usually does break your body down. So spend 20 minutes odd every a couple of times every ride that you're doing in the threshold area, and then the rest of it in that sort of medium sort of lower intensity around about level two.
Right. And so, yeah, just one quick follow-up on that. So when you mentioned that level two, if we use a power meter, what sort of power ranges as percentage of FTP are we talking about there?
So percentage of FTP, round about the 60. 60%, I'd say. I think it's a good level.
Yeah, and that's kind of important to point out that it's pretty easy to go easier than that and get into way easier than that, actually, if you just sit on your bike, as you say, ride with your mates and sit in with the pack and not really pushing yourself at all. So even though you're going easy and not falling into that no man's land, make sure that you're not just sitting there.
Yeah, I mean, if we can give it a bit of a pure number, really. So if your threshold is around about 280 watts, which I think is a fairly common number, really, then your level two will be somewhere around about 160 to 220 watts, roughly. That you should end up spending that sort of base time on.
Yeah. And then, as you said, again, on the quality workouts and the quality segments of workouts, pushing further up closer towards that threshold and avoiding the no man's land in between. What about if you're time constrained and you don't really train a lot? Do you have a lot of athletes that have really strict schedules and maybe they only ride twice per week? How do you do that? Because you can't really do volume on that time budget.
Yeah, I tend to have quite a few of those coming in and wanting coaching, and both in time trialing and Ironman triathlons and so on. The best way forward, as far as I'm concerned, is doing these sort of. If you only can do an hour on the turbo trainer, then 4 times 12 minutes at your threshold with a couple of minutes rest in between tends to be a very, very good workout and actually bring you forward quite dramatically. But then obviously, if you are going to do a longer distance race, you do need at some point to get those bigger hours in. So if you're struggling for time during the week, then cram in a lot of the threshold work and intensity work during the week, and then less so during the weekend, and just get some proper mileage done, but at that very, very strict zone two kind of effort then.
Yeah. And I know that you're a big proponent of power meters. Just how important do you think that they are for triathletes?
I think they are important for any cycling. If you're really, and probably even more so if you're time constrained, because the more precise you can be with your efforts, the more you can actually get out of yourself in the very limited time that you might have available, the better it's going to be for you. And of course, a professional athlete will use it, because it's a performance tool that's going to get that last sort of half a percent to and maybe even less so out of them. And also, in terms of pacing, it is so much easier to pace yourself with a power meter than it is with heart rate, for instance. Because by the time we start moving around in the world, you travel, you then get to a hotter place than what you might have been training in. Your heart rate doesn't respond quite as it used to do during training. And at that point, you find yourself going too hard, going too easy, and so on. And whereas 1 watt is always going to be 1 watt, regardless of whether it's minus five or plus 40 degrees outside, and whether you're tired or not tired, it's always that constant number. So get yourself, I think, a good solid power meter that does read very accurately and very reliably, and you're in a good position going forward.
I do agree, but that said, I know that there are a lot of people that are maybe a bit newer to the sport, and it's not necessarily the right time yet for them to invest, because they, it's an expensive sport and there's a lot of investments to be made anyway. So if you don't have a power meter, there are a lot of athletes that usually have heart rate monitors. So GPS watch and heart rate seems to be something that comes by default on athletes these days. So can you get by on heart rate? How do you use heart rate a lot in your training analysis when you look at your athletes' training?
Of course you can get by on heart rate. I tend to, the majority of the athletes that I coach have got power meters on their bikes, and but we still always use the heart rate as a backup tool should the power meter start playing up, which unfortunately these days there are too many that kind of go a little bit off course. Then we always have the heart rate data as a backup tool to kind of make sure that we're still doing the right things. You know, any tool that you can use that makes your training quantifiable is always going to be better than going on pure feel. Because, you know, saying you've got to go at 80% of perceived maximum effort, that's a very sort of abstract number and kind of a very difficult to pinpoint that where is my maximum, how hard am I actually going at this point, because your 80% of maximum at the start of a ride will be completely different in compared to your 80% when you're actually tired, certainly if you're going by perceived effort. So getting that heart rate is definitely a very, very good tool to work with, and especially if you do know the athlete and the athlete has been recording heart rate for some time, then you can work with the variables that it brings into the athlete's life.
So how can you, do you see a lot of different heart rate responses compared to the power output of the athletes? Because that's something that I know that I see, that sometimes the heart rate can seem very high compared to the power and sometimes very low with different athletes, and it kind of describes their athletic profile, so to say. Is that something that people can even maybe use to get their own profile analyzed themselves if they are self-coached, for example?
Yeah, you can always do that, and like you said, the every athlete is different, every person is different. So if you can profile yourself based on your power and heart rate and work that out, then that's going to obviously help you an awful lot. It'll also tell you we can profile what kind of cadence you should ride at, what's your optimum kind of working level in terms of intensity with the cadence. Not every athlete is going to be able to ride pedal like Chris Froome does up a hill. You know, some riders are actually more efficient going on the lower cadence and powering along than they are to try and spin a bike. So there's so many things that we can work on with all of these different tools that we have available. So I think you're right. Every athlete is definitely very different in that aspect. And the variables of heart rate as well, when we start looking at what time of the day does an athlete train, are they an early riser? What's the heart rate doing at the first part of the day? Certainly if they get up and train in the sort of very, very early morning. I've got some athletes that are up at sort of 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning and they're on the bike training at that point. The heart rate does respond differently to when you come back home after a long day at work and you might be tired and you've just eaten on the way back home, or even just before when you get back home, you have dinner with your family and then you get onto the turbo trainer later on in the evening. And all these points point in during the day, your athlete does your heart rate does change. So we need to be very, very aware of what happens with each athlete, and that can be sometimes the difficulty in making sure that you you understand the athlete as such.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, as a personal anecdote, I'm at the moment really struggling to try to figure out why my maximum heart rate seems to have risen by at least 10 or 15 beats per minute since moving to Portugal from Finland, and it hasn't really been. My maximum heart rate has seemed to be maybe 185 in the past. That has been the absolute maximum that I can get it up to, but now I consistently get it up to the 190s, 195 even, and on some cases, and it's not even spikes, it just looks like a natural heart rate curve, and I have no idea what's happened, why that's happened. Maybe some of it might be stress related in my previous life with too much going on, and now kind of a bit less of that and more stress relief, but I don't think it explains 10 or 15 beats per minute. So it's interesting, but yeah, definitely can be useful. And if in case any listener missed what Maggie was saying about the cadence, then you can, what he meant was that you can try to see where your heart rate, where you're less strained, so your heart rate is a bit lower. And, yeah, and if that is where you are more efficient at that cadence, and when you try to compare different cadences, but at the same power output. So let's move on to, you have a very distinguished road cycling career, as we've touched upon a bit. You've won stages at the Tour de France and the Giro, and you've won the entire Paris-Roubaix in, when was it? 2004, I believe?
2004, yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of really great merits there. Is there anything from your road cycling career that has had an influence on the way that you coach triathletes or time trialists these days, and do you use any training methods from those days that may seem unconventional to this audience of mostly triathletes?
I don't know if it's anything that's unconventional really that I use. Obviously, I've taken snippets from every coach that I've ever worked with, my own experiences and so on, and obviously listening to people around me as well. So it's a constant sort of evolving mechanism in terms of what I do as a coach, and talking to even current professional bike riders and seeing what they're doing, how's the racing changed, what do we need to do to prepare an athlete for that level of racing, and you can take all that and move that along down the road to certainly to time trialing and shorter time trials. It's very, very much unconventional that I do have taken with me from my time as a cyclist. Obviously, I've listened to every single coach. I've taken snippets that have always that's worked well for me. But I also speak to a lot of sort of professional athletes today, cyclists, triathletes, and try and understand what the current sort of scene is like. How has it changed anything since I was in the middle of the action, and what is required from an athlete in today's terms, and then that definitely can certainly, when it comes to cycling and time trialing, I tend to be able to move that into my coaching and use that in my coaching an awful lot. Whereas the sort of certainly the longer distance triathlons, you got to make sure that you're not doing too much top end training. A certain amount you have to kind of do, but obviously cycling is a completely different type of sport. It's a sport where you're reacting to what other riders are doing on a regular basis, whereas Ironman triathlon and even half Ironmans is more of a consistent pace and consistent sort of effort, that where you're just pushing yourself all the time, and you can control the effort that you're making to a different level. And I tend to sort of be very, very reactive with how I coach people, and try and understand the athlete in a very, very deep, on a very deep level, and work with them on the fact of what they're actually training for.
So that's that's a brilliant segue. Actually, let's talk about a few different frameworks, maybe, if you want to call it that, for different types of athletes. So if you have a beginner athlete that is training, let's say, two times per week on the bike, that is, for a shorter race like a sprint or Olympic, how would you use those two rides per week? What kind of training should that athlete maybe do?
I would still work on one session of threshold effort, and just make sure that you're getting that sort of base workout up as high as you can. So obviously the less of an impact a high pace has on your body, the better it's going to be, both for the cycling and also obviously when you're getting onto the run. So to have a high FTP is always going to make your life an awful lot easier. So I would put them down to work on that on one session, and then going into some more sprint related kind of efforts, certainly if we're looking at the sprint and Olympic distance events. Every time you're going through a corner, you need to sort of get out of the saddle, accelerate. And if that takes an awful lot out of your body, then you're going to really struggle by the time you get into the end of that bike riding and get on your feet and start running. So, a bit of sprint and top-end efforts with some threshold efforts on the other session.
And what about an athlete that's training, let's say, three times per week on the bike and they're going to do their first Ironman?
If you're looking at an Ironman effort, then I would definitely go slightly longer efforts and spend a lot more time based on your functional threshold and working on that. So depending on how many hours they have available to ride on those 3 days, I would still put as many, but certainly a good couple of 20-minute efforts into every ride that they're doing. And then have one day then where they're just doing the bigger mileage and just getting that zone 2 ride in building on time on the bike, basically.
And if you're training, you're more intermediate advanced, so you're no longer training for your first Ironman, you're training 3 or maybe even 4 times per week, but it's still an Ironman, that's your goal race. How does it change the type of training that you do?
It doesn't really change an awful lot, to be honest with you. It it just makes it more, you do more of the same, and you keep on pushing. What I would probably build in, if you're we're talking an intermediate to advanced athlete who's now actually racing an Ironman and really pushing the times, is just building some one session of VO2 efforts where they're really pushing the envelope and getting into some top end stuff, just to be able to help the FTP to rise. Because I find on a lot of athletes, you can train your FTP and train it, and it kind of levels out at one particular plateau. And unless you move the VO2 up a notch, there's not really any room for the FTP to move along with it. So I would definitely throw in a session of some VO2 stuff.
Yeah, racing the ceiling. Finally, the final profile that I want to ask about, somewhat selfishly, because this is my profile, an advanced athlete training 4 times per week on the bike for draft legal sprint and Olympic races.
Yeah. I think we need to look at, if it's draft legal races, then we're looking at more actual road racing on the bike. It becomes more bunch sort of related racing. We've got to train a lot of top end, a lot of VO2 efforts to make sure that you can react to the changes in pace, the jumping out of the corners, and also actually build in some certain amount of technical drills to make sure that you are capable. There's so many times that you as a cyclist can go through a corner, and if you're technically better than the rider in front of you, you're only putting half of the effort into going out of the corner, exiting the corner, and getting onto up to speed again, because you know the lines, you can handle the bike well, and so on and so on. So technical drills is something that I think is overseen an awful lot, and probably even more so in triathlon than it is in cycling. So yeah, I'd say find that industrial area where you know, on an evening where you haven't got any cars going around, and you can find a tight technical circuit and go through the corners, try different lines through corners, and work out how you can actually improve your technique. And I bet you know, even actually looking at some bike races where you can pick up a thing or two from the guys that do it, you know, are the best guys in the world at it. So yeah, and then obviously at least one session then where you're really focusing on that strength and VO2 stuff.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That technical stuff is definitely something that I've overlooked, but I definitely see
you're not alone on that one, I can tell you. But you'd be amazed if you can find even a local criterium, you know, or a local sort of league of races where you can go and actually do some road racing. It doesn't have to be, it can be sort of shorter style Kermesse races or circuit races, whatever it is that you can find where you're jumping in with cyclists and you're starting to have the corner with cyclists, and you'll very, very quickly understand the different lines that some of those guys are taking. And by the time you're coming out of a corner and you're gapped 15, 20 meters every time, you also work out what you have to do to be on the wheel of the rider in front of you coming out of that turn, so you don't have to take the wind as much whilst you're trying to accelerate the bike. So I would say try and get into, and if you're doing draft legal racing, it is basically road racing on a bike, and the best guys to do that are the guys that do it every day of the week.
Yeah. So I want to go into your own Ironman racing, because you started doing Ironmans and then you qualified for Kona as an age grouper within, was it 6 months of starting triathlon?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
What was your ability or inability at the start on the swim and run?
Well, the swim and run, swimming was definitely something that I've never done in anger before. You know, I could swim, but I've never really looked at it as a competitive form of, you know, a sport really. So I kind of had a bit of an assessment with a friend of mine who used to be a very good swimmer and also was a coach in triathlon back in the day. And we went down to the local pool, jumped in the water. I think I paddled around at about a minute 50 for the 100 meters, which we thought, okay, that's, we got something to work with there. We can get that down to a half tidy, you know, swimming time. And with the run, it was more a question actually of getting my knees and joints to take the impact after having spent the better part of 20 years not taking any, like basically trying to be off my feet as much as I could to be allow my muscles to recover for in terms of cycling. So it took me the better part of 2 months to actually get to the point where I ran 10 kilometers without actually having any physical problems after. So it was very much a reactive kind of running coaching that we had to do. I also went and looked at how can I run in the most efficient way possible to not damage my joints.
What was that? That's interesting. So how did you do that?
So I started analyzing a lot of stuff on looking at YouTube, what's out there, what are the best runners in the world. You obviously go and look at the guys like Mo Farah and all the rest of the marathon runners. How do they run? What do they do that I didn't do? Learning obviously very, very quickly then that I was heel striking, and that's clearly not a very good thing for your joints. And certainly with the weight that I perform at as well, it was very, very heavy on my body. So I had to learn to midfoot strike, or even to a certain extent toe strike, to get that sort of to lessen the impact on my body. And as soon as I was able to do that, I was able to up the mileage quite a lot as well. So I probably spent a better part of a month and a half just trying to sort of learn to not stride out in front of my body, but actually pushing off backwards a lot more. and kind of falling into the stride a lot. And that was very, very strange, obviously, because as a cyclist, my hip flexors are somewhat tight. So it meant having to go and look at physios. What can we do with this? How can we sort my body out so I can actually do this in an efficient way? And yeah, it took me the better part of, my first ever marathon was actually my first triathlon, which I did up in Sweden in Kalmar. I had not run a full marathon before that. It was only up to about half marathon distance. So that it's certainly very, very interesting to say the least.
Do you have anything else that those are already a couple of points, like especially with the running, but anything that you consider big levers in getting you quickly to a high level that the listeners of this show that may be new to running or swimming or newish to any of these disciplines that you found helped you a lot when it came to improving your ability in those sports?
The swimming is only, there's only one way forward really, and that's find a very, 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 very good swim coach straight away. I was very fortunate to work with Paul Newsome at Swim Smooth.
Oh wow.
Ended up through Hubu, was my wetsuit sponsor at the time. Ended up in a pool together with Paul. He was teaching a whole load of guys here in the UK. He's basically coaching those coaches in the swim smooth techniques. And he was able to, I was fortunate enough to be in the water and be completely picked apart in my terms of my swim stroke. So I went from swimming at the time about a minute 40 odd per 100 meters to the point where I could barely float after they picked me apart completely, and then put my swim stroke back together again, and all of a sudden I was down to about 125 per 100 for quite some time. So I was very lucky to have that opportunity. But with that, I also, you know, really very quickly realized that if you're going to do something well, you research who the best coaches in your area are at teaching these kind of things, and you go and see them. It's the same as, you know, if you've got to ride a bike fast, you go and speak to the guys who know how to ride a bike, and it's just quite straightforward, really.
Yeah, brilliant. So I have a couple of more short questions. Let's take these really quickly, but there are a couple of listener questions that came in just the other night. And the first one is, do you have an opinion on the potential benefits of oval chain rings?
I've tried every single type of oval chain ring there is. Some of them do feel like they actually give you a bit of help. Whether they do or not is still something that we cannot really 100% understand. I guess if it feels like it works for you, then it probably does work for you. But like I said, there isn't really, it's so difficult to quantify with the power meters, because the power meters kind of read, they think that we're pedaling with a round chainring, that the tangential force is always constant, which, you know, with an oval chainring, they aren't. My own personal opinion, if you are going to go oval, then you need to go extremely oval for it to really have any kind of proper benefit. So we're talking 25% ovalization or more to really get the proper benefits from having the oval chain rings. That's just the way I've tested it, and I've tried every oval, square, whatever you can possibly throw at me, just to kind of understand whether I actually rode any faster or not.
Yeah. And the other question that came in is, this one is from Dan, and he talked about marginal aero gains. And do you have any tips for that you use and encourage your athletes to do to get those marginal gains? Like he mentions, for example, waxed chains, oversized pulley wheels, overshoes, aero socks, and so on.
At this point in time, if you're going to look for the oversized pulley wheels and go down that whole route and get the marginal gains of that one, I'm expecting that he's probably spent the better part of a week in the wind tunnel already, because that's probably where you're going to get the biggest gains. Or go and see someone who really understands aerodynamics and the position on the bike, because let's face it, you can change all the bits and pieces on your bike to make that a little bit more aerodynamic. But at the end of the day, it's the guy on top of the bike that has got the biggest drag factor. And with that, there's so many guys that I see that still haven't got a good position on the bike, both in terms of putting the power out, but also in terms of what they do with the frontal area. And even now, to a certain extent, there's so many people starting to work on the frontal area, but forget about what happens further down the line. So go and see someone who really understands the aerodynamics on the bike, and work with those guys. And if you have a really, really good bike fitter as well, they will understand what to do with a time trial bike to get you as fast and as slippery as possible in the wind and get the numbers out at the same time.
Yeah, that's an important message to get across. We've had quite a few episodes on that topic, and it's the same every time, that really the guy sitting on the bike is the reason for most of the drag, and that's what you need to spend all of your work on until you have optimized that, really.
Yeah, I mean, we've done quite a bit of work on that over the last 6 months now, since I started doing bike fits and stuff myself. And we've had guys come in, and I've managed to shave, the better part of 10, 12 minutes off their Ironman times on a bike, just by putting them in an aerodynamic position where they actually can put the numbers out. So there's so many riders and athletes still getting it wrong. And just going super low in the front and think they're aero, and all of a sudden they don't understand why their FTP on the time trial bike is 40, 50 watts lower than what it is on their road bike, and why they all of a sudden go slower on that. So get yourself down to a good bike fitter and speak to them, and I'm sure they can help out to get you fitted properly.
Yeah, good advice. And as I said, Chris, the listener that told me about you, he has, as I understand, also gotten a bike fit from you. Is that correct? And anyway, yeah. So he's been heaping praise on you. So if you live in your area of the United Kingdom, where is it that you're located?
I'm based down in Newport. That's where I got my fit studio. So if you want to get in touch, then just look it up on backstepbikefit.com and get in touch, and we can certainly help you improve your position on the bike.
Brilliant. All right, let's move into the rapid fire questions, and let's keep this really short, 15 seconds or so. And let's start with, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to triathlon or cycling?
Oh, good question. I tend to be still very much on cycling news for cycling. Triathlon, various different ones.
What's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Stubbornness, and never stop looking for that next thing that's going to help me improve. Always look for the next level, so you're never sort of happy with where you're at. There's always a way to improve yourself. Nothing is ever perfect.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned there earlier about your how you progressed in your Ironman career, that is a great example, like studying Mofar on YouTube and seeking out Paul Newsom for swim coaching. So that's a good takeaway. And finally, what do you wish you had known or wish you had done differently at some point in your career?
Being a bit more patient with as a cyclist when I was injured, and not wanting to come back to the highest level as quickly as I probably did. There's a number of times where I, rushed back from an injury without doing the rehab and taking the time to actually get myself up to fitness level again, but just kind of half jobbing it and getting onto a bike and racing again as soon as I possibly could. I reckon I would have been racing up until about a couple of years ago if I'd been doing things smart.
Okay, so Magnus, this has been really, really fantastic to have a chat with you. I really learned a lot and appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. If the listeners want to learn more about you, your website is on bekstedtcoaching.com, and we'll have that in the show notes because it's a Swedish name that's not even for Swedish-speaking people like myself too easy to spell. So it will be on the show notes on That Triathlon Show and in the episode description in your podcast app. And we'll also link to your Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, I think those are your main social media accounts.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you want to mention before we close off this interview?
No, I'd just say thank you very much for having me, and it's been great having a chat. So look forward to having your listeners come in with questions as well.
Yeah, brilliant. It's been great fun. All right, people, this has been Magnus Bäckstedt. It was really great talking to you, Magnus.
Thank you very much.
I hope that you enjoyed that episode as much as I did. I really got a lot out of it. I think Magnus dropped a ton of value bombs on us there. There really are a lot of important takeaways, but if I have to pick a couple that stood out the most to me, they would be first doing threshold training and how effective that is for raising your cycling ability. And second, something we hear about a lot on this podcast, but it bears repeating. So many triathletes do way too much moderate intensity training, no man's land training. And I know that you know that already. You've heard that a lot of times. Many of you, most of you know that. But do you follow it? You can always go and check your training log and see if you're actually adhering to the advice. But another takeaway here related to this is not to let it spill over on the other side either and get into just sitting and chilling on your bike. Like, well, you can maybe chill a little bit, but not too much. That level 2, zone 2 training is still, when you go at it for a long time, it's still work. It's not just sitting there and smelling the roses all the time. So that's my main takeaway, probably, to stay out of that no man's land, but also, as Magnus said, trying to be particular about getting into that zone 2 or level 2, whatever you want to call it. And what do you think were the most important take-home messages? I would really like it if you could go to thattriathlonshow.com and click through to the show notes that you can find there as usual and post in the comments on those show notes, and we can have a discussion about it on that blog post or that show notes post and keep that discussion open for everybody to see. So that's something that I'm trying to get more into, and I really think that it could be useful for a lot of the listeners. Obviously, the show notes will also have all the details from this episode as usual, so if there's anything you want to check, you can go and have a look at that on that show notes page. Again, that's thattriathlonshow.com. If you haven't already, I want to pick a few different related episodes that on cycling training, I should say, that I think are my most recommended cycling-specific episodes. When it comes to cycling training, I haven't picked like aerodynamic episodes or things like that, but more when it comes to the training side of things, training and potentially racing a little bit. So here goes. Here's my list of top picks for you to go and listen to next if you haven't. Cycling Science and Myth Busting Part 1 and 2 with Stephen Chung. Those are episodes 74 and 75. Performance Training Tactics and Physiology of Cycling and Running in Triathlon. That was a mouthful. With Naroa Echevarria, that was episode 61. That was a really good one, really popular one. Then we have Structured Power-Based Cycling Training with Chad Timmerman, episode 38. Chad is head coach at Trainer Road, which many of you are probably using, so go and listen to that. Chad is really, really great and has a lot of influence on how I coach, to be honest, so I really, really like his approach. And finally, Training Zones Part 2, Cycling. So these are cycling-specific training zones, how to use them, what they are. You should definitely listen to this if you don't know this like the back of your hand. Episode 29, go and have a look at that. All of them can be found on thattriathlonshow.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And by the way, make sure that you subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already so you don't miss any episodes like these or other important ones in the future. Final call to action for today. At the moment of recording, which is the 12th of December 2017, I sit at roughly 70 ratings and reviews for That Triathlon Show. And as I talked about before, I set myself the big goal of reaching 100 5-star ratings and reviews by the end of this year. Well, if you're listening to this episode, you know that we're coming up on the end of this year within just a few days. So if you have been getting value from this podcast during this year, please take a couple of minutes to go to iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever app you happen to be using and give the show an honest rating and review. this goal isn't just for show. It really is an important one to me. I need to prove to myself that all the work that I put into it is worth it and that it has an impact. So I'd be so, so happy if you could help me out in reaching this goal of getting 100 five-star ratings and reviews. But as I said, you don't need to make it an honest rating and review because I want your honest feedback. And finally, thank you again to Precision Hydration for sponsoring this episode. Remember to take their free online sweat test on precisionhydration.com to get your personalized hydration strategy for your next race. And use the discount code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, for 15% off. Thank you, as always, for listening. I highly, highly appreciate you and you listening in every Monday and Thursday. Subscribe so that you don't miss any of those Monday and Thursday episodes, as I told you. And in the meantime, keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.